Good morning to you. Welcome to this October 16th edition of Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley, and I'm here with my co-host, Doug Wells. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning. Boy, what a beautiful weekend. The leaves were, I think, were just a little past the peak, but still spectacular.
It was gorgeous out there, and we woke up to snow on Saturday, and it was cold, but it cleared up, and the sun came out just in time for the shot ski record on Main Street.
Did you go to that?
Oh, I was there.
Awesome.
I had a place. I was there right at noon.
And how did we do? Is it Breckenridge that we're competing with?
It is Breckenridge we compete with. And I think there's a nice gentlewoman's agreement with Breckenridge that will one-up each other every single time. But it was a beautiful afternoon. I think it was 1,250 people they had on the shot ski. It was an engineering marvel. It was a social success. A great time was had by all.
The shot ski, an engineering marvel. All right, I'll take you at your word at that.
You have to see the folks from Sunrise Rotary and see how they did it. I think they have a video on their Facebook page. It's quite interesting. We've got an interesting show for our listeners this morning. A smattering of many different topics, starting with Red Ledges, a beautiful development out in the Heber Valley. Believe it or not, folks, they are celebrating their 10th year anniversary. We're going to hear from Mitchell Burns, the COO of Red Ledges, about that.
And then keeping with the smattering or eclectic mix, our second guest is going to be a local company. They're kind of a technology company. They make keyboards for iPads. We're going to hear how they launched a hardware device like that. It's one of the most popular keyboards for iPads. And then our final guest is going to be Rudy Salvatore. He is with Makaya Caters, which is Haitian food. They run a very popular food truck, and we're going to hear more about their business. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. We'll be back in a moment. Please.
This is Nanette Bush with Fairway Independent Mortgage, supporter and longtime listener of KPCW. Fairway Independent Mortgage offers personal home, vacation home, and investment property lending. Our mortgage team partners with local realtors to provide our clients with resources to understand the home finance process. Located at 1700 Park Avenue or at nanettebush.com.
Mountain Money on KPCW is sponsored in part by Columbus Pacific Properties, presenting Viridian, 21 new residences along the 11th fairway of the Canyons Golf Course with year-round amenities and gondola access. Summer's on the fairway, winter's on the slopes. More information at ViridianParkCity.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. The time is 9:09. I'm Renee Bodley here with my co-host Doug Wells. And our first guest this morning is Mitchell Burns, COO of Red Ledges. Good morning, Mitchell.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
And I bet it's really pretty out in Red Ledges this morning.
It's gorgeous. We love that valley and, you know, the topography we got over there, the trees and the rock, and then great, you know, Mount Timpanogos. Boy, I wake up every morning and I'm just amazed.
Best view of Timp I've ever seen is from Red Ledges, that's for sure. Let's remind our viewers what Red Ledges is, a four-season mountain community. You're in the Heber Valley. You have about 2,000 acres. You have homes that range from about $700,000 to $10 million. Wow.
Yeah, it's quite a range. We like to say we've got something for everybody, but the $700,000 range, those would be some townhomes, and then we have custom homes that are being built that we can only imagine how much they cost. We have one going in that's about 27,000 square feet. We got another one at 24,000 square feet. So we have everything from a 2,000 square foot cabin to pick your size monster custom home.
Is that common within gated communities to have such a range of values?
Yeah, and so the way it works for us is we have a lot of people that they come in, they want to build their custom home, they want to build their dream home, but they want to participate in the community and the club life immediately. So we've built some cottages and some townhomes that they'll come and they'll buy that and they'll live there while they're building their custom home, and then they'll sell the cottage to somebody else. So you'll see that quite a range of people moving up.
You guys were part of the home tour. Was it this past year or the year before?
We've been part of the home tour, the last 5 years.
Last 5 years. And so a lot of people who might not otherwise get down to Heber Valley and look at Red Ledges are exposed to Red Ledges through that tour. And when I talked to some folks this weekend about interviewing you today, almost all of them said, oh, we remember going out there for the home tour. Really impressed that is out there and the views that you have. How many homes altogether in this 2,000-acre development?
So we're master planned for about 1,100 homes, but currently we've have 140 that have been built, but we have 70 under construction right now. So it's just booming. There's a lot of construction going on. And we've also sold about 500 of the 1,100 home sites. So we've got a lot in the pipeline of people that are getting ready to build.
And the reason you're here is because you celebrated your 10th year anniversary last Friday, on Friday the 13th.
Yeah, it was really appropriate. When you launch a community of this size in October of 2007, as we're falling off the cliff into the Great Recession, it's only appropriate that our exact 10th anniversary is on Friday the 13th. So we all got a chuckle out of that.
What were you thinking in October of 2007?
We knew we were heading for recession, but nobody knew how, monstrous it was going to be. We thought, hey, it'd be a year, maybe 2 years of recession. So let's get launched. Let's continue to build the infrastructure. Let's build the golf course and the club, and we'll just ride it out. We had no idea how deep the recession was going to be.
So, oftentimes real estate developers will talk about horizontal improvements on the land, the property, which is getting everything ready so that the homes can be built, and the homes being built themselves are vertical improvements. How far along on the horizontal improvements, the infrastructure, were you 10 years ago?
So let's see. When we launched 10 years ago, we were working on the first phase, which was like the first maybe 8 miles of road. And we had the roads were graded out, and we had some of the infrastructure below it. Like we had the water and sewer lines in, but we weren't that far along.
How about financing wise? Were you did you have a big line with the bank? And that was one of the big problems with this recession. It wasn't a classic recession where business just slows down. Financing was getting ripped away from everybody, including developers.
Yeah, so we actually hadn't taken out that big of a loan compared to some of our competitors. We were, maybe 20% of what some of the others had done. So we didn't have a huge line, but what we had backing us were the two principals, so Tony Burns and Nolan Archibald. They had pretty deep pockets themselves, so we didn't have to rely that much on heavy bank financing.
And you have a family history with this land.
Yeah. So the land that we were developing was something, part of it had been in my mother's family for generations. So part of that land we had purchased from my aunt, who is Phyllis Christensen, who, if you've ever been over to Holiday Lanes, a little bowling alley, if you go in there and see the little old lady that sits behind the counter, that's Phyllis. That's my aunt. Matter of fact, about half the land that we have as part of Red Ledges came from her and her family. The other half, my father had actually acquired starting in like 1979. I think he made his first purchase, and it took us 33 years and about 27 transactions to really assemble all of that land.
And that was your father's vision all along, was to assemble it so that he could create a community like Red Ledges?
I think in 1979, I don't know if he was thinking about making the community, but somewhere along the lines, he was based in Florida, and my mother having grown up in Heber, we would always come back and vacation here. And so he always had this draw to come back to the Heber Valley. So I knew he always wanted to do something. I'm not sure when the actual vision was crystallized, maybe about 20 years ago. It started to come together.
So your mom owned the land. What's your dad's background that he would end up with a vision like this?
So my dad was actually born and raised in Mesquite, Nevada. And, after coming out of Mesquite, he went to Dixie College in the 60s, and that's where he met my mom. And then from there went to BYU in the early 60s, and then went from BYU to Berkeley. So to get an MBA at Berkeley. I don't know if you can imagine going in 1963, going from BYU to Berkeley, but that's got to be a cultural just shift right there. And so from there, he went into business. He worked for Mobil Oil, and then from there went to Ryder Systems. But he was always in corporate America, and he had a business philosophy where he said he either owned stock in the businesses that he worked in, or he bought land in places he knew. So he bought land in Heber because he knew Heber from my mother being there, and and just the generations spending time in Heber.
It's interesting hearing your family history with the Heber Valley, because so much growth in Heber is often attributed to what they call the, quote, move-ins, and the people they think have no ties to the area. You've had some challenges developing in the Heber Valley, both, you know, challenges that any developer has with any local government, but also challenges with sort of the culture and the mindset of the people who've lived there for a long time.
Yeah, it's when I moved here 12 years ago to you know, help the family put this together, I got a knock on the door pretty early on, and there's a guy, and I won't tell you his name, but he handed me a flyer, and he said, and the flyer said, come out to this public forum and stop the mega rich out of state developers from raping and pillaging the land. I said, well, that's quite interesting.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you. And who are you? And he told me his name. I said, and when did you move to the Valley? He said, well, I moved here from New Jersey 2 years ago. So I always thought that was interesting. My family, having been here for generations, I felt, and coming out here and visiting my grandparents in the summer, and I felt a real responsibility to not just come in and, you know, rape and pillage the land. This is a legacy that we're building to honor, you know, my grandparents and my ancestors that had been there and had been, you know, ranchers and for generations. And they loved that land, and they got up every morning and they looked at it, and they were stewards of that land, and they handed that down. And I feel like that's my responsibility to take care of it now.
And give us some, I think that's interesting, you know, kind of a legacy for your grandparents. Give us some ways that's materialized at Red Ledges.
Well, I think that Heber Valley is an area that's been discovered and it's growing. And there's two ways that it can grow. It can just be, let's go bulldoze everything down and, you know, bulldoze over the trees and just, you know, throw up homes. For us, you know, we try to development isn't, there's always that change and there's a little bit of destruction to the land. So you want to do it in a way where you don't just bulldoze through the 300 and 400 year old trees and chop them all down. You try to lay the roads in, you try to position the homes so that you can leave those monuments of beauty, whether they're the Utah junipers that are there or the beautiful rock formations. Don't just go blow them up. Like, for instance, we're named after the Red Ledges. And if you've been out there, you've seen that there's actually these great red sandstone outcroppings. Some of the early planners wanted us to go build a clubhouse right on top of it. And I just looked at it and I said, I don't think that's honoring the land to blow the top off of that hill and put a big building on top of it. So we advocated for moving the clubhouse and some of the recreational facilities down into kind of a flatter area and leaving the Red Ledges that were named after, leaving them there intact.
Yeah, no, once it's done, it's obvious that was the right game plan. But at the time, I'm sure it was controversial. And it wasn't just a straightforward decision, because you've got people that are quote-unquote experts telling you this is the way you're supposed to do it. You know, as our first guest, we have a little extra time with you than we do with our next two guests. So I want to go back to that challenging period during the financial crisis, because you know, it was in the stock market, you know, we hit the bottom in 2009, and pretty much it was a pretty smooth road out from there. It looked scary at the time, but in real estate, it dragged on for a while. And I think we forget, as a town, there were some big projects here that, had they gone under, you know, I'm not sure what the town would have done, including the Montage. You know, the Montage up at Deer Valley, they had wrapped that in plastic because they had to stop work for a while just because of the financing of it. So the project was uncertain for a period of time. Was there a period where you were unsure whether Red Ledges was going to survive that financial crisis?
Well, yeah, there are some times you woke up in the morning and you said, wow, I've got to get some sales to keep operating.
But there were no sales out there. Nobody was buying high-end property like that, or were they?
So our bottom was in 2010, where we only sold 20 properties. But we were able to always eke out a few sales just to keep things going. And at that point, it's really slash all your operating costs. That's where, you know, our club was. We went in and we were able to you know, cut operating costs. You know, we slashed 30% and 40% out of, and 50% out of those operating costs just so that we could survive. I think our blessing was we didn't have huge bank loans that were getting called. Also, some of the financing that we had, we relied on, you know, relationships from the two principals, so Tony Burns and Nolan Archibald, where they had spent 30 and 40 years in business. They had relationships with banks and individuals, and we were able to leverage those relationships to make sure that loans didn't get called. So it was really a lesson in never burn a bridge, because you know, you can go back and ask people for help. And you know, the combination of deep pockets from the principals, great relationships in banking, we were able to go back to, you know, places like Zions Bank and then some private individuals to help us. It was really a struggle.
And conservative financing, which is a common theme when you talk to developers who survived that crisis, was they didn't overextend themselves on the debt side.
That's right.
And just to put it in perspective for our listeners, we were talking about you had the Promontories, the Touahays, the Victory Ranches. Promontory and Touahay were maybe a little bit older than Red Ledges, but we all know what happened with those three developments. All of them went belly up in some form or another, and you guys stayed solvent.
Yeah, sometimes we wonder, was that a good thing or not? But where we had our personal reputations on the line, and where we had kind of the legacy of being from the valley and it being family land, that really wasn't an option for us. So we just kept fighting. And we're very proud of that. And we're very proud that, you know, people should want to do business with us because we fight to help our owners, you know, which we consider partners with us. And we wanted to make sure that we protected them in addition to what we're doing.
You should be proud of that. I mean, that was very difficult period. And speaking of being proud, you know, you're also proud that today we're celebrating your 10th year anniversary. What are you guys doing at Red Ledges to celebrate there?
So this is the 10th anniversary of opening for business, for sales. The club hasn't been around for 10 years yet. That's still another year and a half off. But biggest celebration, we have new releases of property that we're bringing out. So on the sales and marketing side, we've just released about 40 new home sites. We've got special incentives for pricing on those things and for the club. We're going to be throwing, you know, series of parties for the members over the next couple of months just to talk about where we've been, and I've been digging out old photos of what it looked like before we started and as we're under construction. So just going to be doing a lot of talking about it and reminiscing about what it's been like as we've evolved over the last 10 years.
And you're a golf community. You have other amenities, but you have a golf course out there, and you just opened a golf park. I mean, golf and country clubs and those kinds of estates don't really appeal to millennials as much, but you found a way to kind of keep a younger edge to it.
Yeah, so the golf park has been a tremendous success. It's been open for just about a year. We call it the Jack Nicklaus Signature Golf Park. It's the first one and only one of its kind that Jack designed for us. And the whole idea behind that is let's try to make golf more accessible and more fun, especially for people that are not particularly avid golfers, but want to just try it out. It's 12 holes of par 3, and there are really no rules on it. I play it all the time. I live, my house is right on the golf park, and I take my dog, Mozzie, and we go out, and I take a couple of golf clubs, play barefoot, and just kind of hit the ball around. It's a very friendly, very forgiving course. We even put two holes on it. We have the standard hole for the people that are great golfers, and then we have an 8-inch hole, which is monstrous. It's like, you know, it's like a bucket, so you can sink a putt from 50 feet away if you want to. And we have golf boards, which are like motorized skateboards that you can ride around on the golf park, so you can like surf the earth, is what they say. It's really fun, and you see great big groups of people. You see grandparents with grandkids and groups of 6 and 8. It's just fun to see people go around and do whatever they want.
How much does it cost to do that?
Well, as a member, there's really no additional cost. You just you play for free, but you have to be a member of the club.
Oh, so the public can't go out there and take part.
Unfortunately, that's our carrot to get people interested in buying
or
and living out there.
Or you need to be friends with the member, which works out very nicely.
I see where we're going with this.
Yes, exactly. I have a couple friends that are out there, but I'll add you to the list as well if that's okay. So we had you on about a year ago, and you had announced a partnership with an East Coast company at the time. And the idea was, you know, theirs was, if I'm not mistaken, was like an ocean seaside resort. And the idea is it couples nicely with having a mountain town resort, and there'd be some synergies with the two groups. It's been 6 months. It's been a year. How's that going?
Yeah, that's going really well. So that's we've been building a relationship and a partnership with the people that own Kiowa Island, which is in South Carolina. And Kiowa Island is like the creme de la creme of golf communities that are on the ocean. And what we realized was that we needed to attract more people to come to Park City from places that haven't necessarily heard of Utah or been to Utah. So the folks in South Carolina, you know, are really good at marketing up and down the East Coast. And, you know, sometimes when you talk to people in North Carolina, say, hey, have you heard of Utah? Would you like to come? Park City's a beautiful place. And they're like, well, I'm not going to Utah. I go to Colorado. And they're like, well, okay, have you heard of Kiowa? And they're like, yeah. I said, well, come to like Red Ledges. It's like the Kiowa of the mountains. And so it's kind of building us, giving us some credibility amongst the East Coast. And we're trying to grow the market so that we have more people can come and discover Utah, which I don't know. Some of the locals are here, maybe not excited about that, but when you're selling a community.
We're a tourist town.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the reality of our situation here. You know, and on that topic, when you say, you know, a lot of folks maybe haven't really embraced the idea of Utah yet, don't know the Utah that we know here. The partnership with the Park City Chamber obviously is important. Are there things that you think we as a town should be doing, could be doing, that would get the word out better for your clientele?
So I think that the Chamber does a great job. I think Park City does a great job. It's at marketing itself across the country. I think it's less Park City and more just Utah in general. Sometimes I think we shoot ourselves in the foot with some of the regulations and laws that we put out there that make us sound more quirky than we actually are. So of all the people that I know personally that have never been to Utah but came to visit, let's say, you know, my friends came to visit me, 100% of them have said, I had no idea how great this place was. I had no idea how easy it is to get to. They love the skiing here. They love the summer activities here. So I think Park City's doing a great job. I think it's at more of the state level that we need to have a little bit work on our reputation.
Of the 140 homes that are built at Red Ledges right now and the 70 that are being built, what percentage are second homes?
Do you know, we're about 50% primary and 50% second home right now, which is a little bit higher than we expected. We find that people are, once they get to Red Ledges, I think they fall in love with the community. There's a real strong sense of community amongst the club members and the club activities. I think people just want to be there.
And of those homes, how many came in from outside of Utah? How many are native Utahns of your homeowners?
Well,
hard to say.
So I'm trying to think about that. I think we're about 60-70% from out of state right now.
But 50% primary. So these are people, are they commuting to Provo or Salt Lake, or are they retired?
A lot of them are retired and empty nesters. A lot of them can work out of the home. But we've got people that are, yes, we have some commuting to Salt Lake, but a lot commuting down into the Provo-Orem area.
Mitchell Burns, we have run out of time. Oh. I just looked at the clock and realized that we're actually run over. Is there anything else you want to add for our listeners about Red Ledges?
You know, I just want to thank you guys for having me on. We're very excited out at Red Ledges. And come out, and if you haven't seen us or if you haven't been out there in the last couple of years, I think you'll be surprised at how much we've grown. So I invite you to come out and see us.
Thank you for being here, Mitchell Burns with Red Ledges. Stay tuned to Mountain Money. Coming up next, we're going to talk to the people who brought you one of the most popular accessories for your iPad. Stay tuned.
Joining the Park City Chamber Bureau provides your business with lots of benefits, from business-to-business networking and promotional opportunities to access to our 1,000-plus membership database. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit, membership-based organization and a proud KPCW supporter.
This is Ryan Hoffman, manager at Mountain West Bank, sponsor of KPCW. We're a community bank with a great understanding of our local needs. Mountain West Bank has something unheard of nowadays, but I can't say it on the radio. We're next to the movies near Kearns Boulevard at 649-3369. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Cookies on Fridays.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Congratulations again to Red Ledges on their 10th year anniversary. In studio with us now, we have Nick Smith. He is the chief executive officer of a company called Bridge Keyboards, which makes one of the premier iPad keyboards. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. So your company started, I believe, like 2012 is when you did your Kickstarter campaign to get going?
It did. It goes back to sort of May 2012.
So talk to us. We've all seen keyboards now for our iPads available today, but what was it like in 2012? Were there keyboards for that? Were you one of the first? What was it like?
There were. I think the market back then was very, I suppose, very early days for iPad keyboards. The majority on the market, in fact, all were on the market, were all plastic. And the irony to that is that the iPad is such a beautiful device. It's made of, you know, aluminum, and it really is, I suppose, crafted to be not just a functional accessory, but more of a statement, more of a fashion statement as well. So when we looked at the market, back with the Kickstarter team, they recognized that there was a big gap, and so they made a full aluminum keyboard for iPad.
You know, I wish I had seen your Kickstarter campaign. We're going to talk about Kickstarter in a second, because I'm a big keyboard fan. If you have an iPad and you want it, it's a great as a consumer to consume information. But if you want to use it as a productivity tool, you really need a keyboard. And there back then weren't many choices. My favorite back then was a Zag.
Yes.
And I wanted it to be thin.
Yes.
What was your vision? What did you want Bridge to be?
Well, I got involved with the company in around 2014 and restarted it then. And what we saw was that there'd been very little innovation from the beginning, from 2010, 2011, when Zag came to market and Logitech came to market with fabulously functional keyboards. But you're right, when we looked at the market in 2014, there was nothing that was starting to trend towards something that was beautifully designed, that really took that notion of an accessory no longer just being functional, it needs to also be, you know, beautiful as well at the same time.
When we were looking at your company earlier today, Nick, we noticed that you won the CES, Consumer Electronics Show, Innovation Award for 2016 and 2017.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
What is innovative about your keyboard? I guess you've done such a good job of making keyboards commonplace that I thought, well, that's interesting that a keyboard would win an Innovation Award.
It's strange, but I think one of our philosophies is, you know, try and say as much as you can with as little as possible. And that resonates to the actual design as well. So our design is incredibly simplistic. You know, if you were to get two iPads and put them together, for example, that's what you get when you pair our keyboard with an iPad. So what we've done, we've got a very minimalist design, which essentially makes the iPad look like a MacBook and function like a MacBook, but yet it's an iPad. And you raised a great point, which is iPads are becoming such, you know, big productivity tools. Apple's marketing them as supercomputers. Well, without a keyboard, they're really limited. So that's why we've really taken the Mac notion of a MacBook and brought it to iPad.
And what communication have you had with Apple about your product? How do you get to be an Apple-approved accessory?
Well, these don't need to be Apple approved, but we have a blessing from Apple. You know, it's always a great experience when you walk into a sales meeting and literally every Apple employee that's, you know, in the meeting is using your keyboard. You know, it's made like an Apple product. It looks like an Apple product, but it's not an Apple product. That's what they say. So,
and you joined the company in 2014. Take us back there. What was going well with the company? What were the challenges for the company back
then?
Well,
that's actually the interesting point. So the Kickstarter team, literally after the Kickstarter campaign, which did success, you know, very, very, very well.
About $800,000
yeah,
you guys
exactly.
raised, which is a huge Kickstarter success.
In 2012, that was about the fifth largest. It was quite remarkable for a keyboard. I was living in Singapore with my wife, and my best mate was in town as well. And we saw an opportunity because I saw this keyboard in Korea actually and tried to buy one and I couldn't. And long story short, got in touch with them and I said, oh, can you send one to Singapore? And they said, no, we couldn't. So we bought 200 of them, built a website and sold them all very, very quickly within 3 or 4 weeks. And that was the start to say, okay, this has got a significant opportunity behind it. Let's really look at what it would mean if we were to take this to market. So after some back and forth, we ended up owning a keyboard company, and you know, 3 or 4 years later, we're now based in Park City with 15 employees just down the road, and we sell in over 148 countries and around 3,000 retail stores.
So you moved here from Singapore. Why Park City? We're glad to have you.
Yeah, why Park City? Look, I used to work for Adobe, actually. So I used to come to Salt Lake quite often and would sort of bypass Salt Lake and just come straight to Park City for the skiing. So when we were looking at different places in the US from an economics perspective, West Coast, you know, is not really the best place to try and start a business, and the East Coast was just simply too far from China and Asia, where we've got a significant business in our manufacturing. So we wanted to be somewhere quite central, somewhere great for our families, and you know, somewhere we could get access to great talent. And obviously with Skullcandy here, we thought that that was a fair indicator that there's a lot of great talent in this sector around the region.
Tell us a little bit more about your background.
So my background is originally management consulting with Accenture. And prior to that, I had a startup in Australia as well. So quite diverse, but really digital strategy is my background. But like Toby, my business partner, and my wife, we're all quite entrepreneurial and ambitious. So when we saw this product, or what was the original product, thinking that there was an opportunity to be the masters of our own destiny was probably a smarter option than working 9 to 5 for a big company.
You know, you mentioned Skullcandy. And Skullcandy for a long time was a scrappy company. Really got their start by backing people in cool sports like skateboarding and snowboarding, folks that aren't that expensive to sponsor, yep, to get the word out. Now, yours is different. You can't do celebrity endorsements, I'm thinking. I mean, if Tim Cook were to endorse that would mean a lot. But short of that, and I don't think Tim's looking for endorsement deals. But Skullcandy's big break was when they started getting the big boxes like Best Buy.
Yes.
And that's when they went to the next level.
Yes.
You guys are in Best Buy as well. Tell us about that process. How did you get into Best Buy?
A lot of perseverance. It's a challenging organization to work with and can be incredibly rewarding, but it's also stressful at the same time because of the nature of the beast. But, you know, retail is such a core part of our business that, you know, if you really want to drive success, then Best Buy is a key part of that recipe. But there are other major retailers around particularly in this market, that are key. It's sort of, we tend to take a portfolio approach at the way we approach our different retailers. But Best Buy has been, you know, challenging, but also rewarding at the same time for us.
And you do keyboards. Are you looking at doing any other kinds of accessories?
We are actually. So we've actually got a keyboard for Microsoft Surface as well. So that keyboard's actually in Best Buy down in Kimball. But that product is very different in terms of our keyboards for iPad. Obviously, it looks like a Microsoft Surface and creates a laptop out of the Microsoft Surface, unlike the traditional type cover. But we also have a new range of accessories actually that are coming out for holiday, which are all associated with the ecosystem around the connected desktop and mobile. So batteries, cables, chargers, all those sorts of things, which really just makes sense to add on to what we've got.
Yeah, now you mentioned the Surface. The key difference, and I'm an iPad fan, I'm an Apple fan, but the key difference between the iPad and the Surface is the Surface is a fully functioning laptop. I've got a keyboard for my iPad, and I know what the big difference is. What's the challenge with the keyboard for the iPad? What's missing that you'd probably love to see Apple introduce?
Look, I think if I had a dollar for every time someone said, put a trackpad on your keyboard, I'd probably wouldn't be selling
Precisely.
Keyboards anymore.
Exactly, yeah.
Unfortunately, we're limited because of the iOS. It's a touch device, and our keyboards really are just simple. They're really great to type on, and to add in a trackpad would just take it to the next level. But then that opens up a whole new can of worms when it comes to Mac and iPad and where it all sits together in the whole ecosystem.
And you have speakers as well with your keyboard?
You've done your research. So the original Kickstarter keyboard had a speaker built into it. Now, this was when the iPad had terrible speakers. So the first, I suppose, two iterations of what that we did of the keyboard also had speakers in it, and they were fantastic. But then once Apple started to talk four speakers in the iPad and the sound really is quite good, we figured their R&D budget was much greater than our keyboard budget, so we decided not to put them in anymore. But there are still some legacy keyboards out there that have speakers in them, and people who have got an iPad Air, for example, love them.
I would think when Apple introduces a new iPad, it's very advantageous in your business to get the keyboard out there as soon as possible.
Yes.
The challenge is, I'm guessing, Apple doesn't let you know 6 months ahead of time. Here's what you need is the dimensions.
Unfortunately not, but we are actually very, very lucky. So we have a keyboard for every iPad through Mini 1, 2, 3 and the iPad Mini 4. But when you talk the Bridge 9.7, that was the keyboard that I originally designed, which is for the iPad Air. Now, what's unique about our keyboard is that the way that the iPad connects to the keyboard. Now, unlike the Zags or the Logis where you've got a big chunky plastic shell, we don't. So what we've actually been able to do is make a clamp that is universal. So our keyboard works with the iPad Air, the Air 2, the Pro 9.7, and the 5th gen iPad. So actually, whenever Apple have released a new iPad on the 9.7 range, we've been the first to market because our old keyboard worked with it. Which has been fantastic for us. For a small company to get that jump has been brilliant.
That helps you in two areas, right? It helps you that you can be a first mover just because your existing design works. It also helps from an inventory standpoint because when you're dealing with Best Buy, how many stores do they have?
Over 1,000? We're in 814 stores.
Okay, so almost 1,000.
Yeah.
If you had to pull out inventory, that would kill you.
It's massive. We've had to do it once, and touch wood, we never have to do it again. That's the biggest challenge with working with the likes of Best Buy. But one of the great things about our product is that universal nature of it. From a retail perspective, they see that as a great thing because they can have one SKU dealing with multiple potential iPad customers. So that broadens the reach of it.
Let's bring it back home here to Park City. You do have an office here in Park City.
We do. We're actually in Skullcandy's original offices on 1910 Prospector Avenue.
And how many employees again?
We've got 15 in the office, and we've got another 5 scattered around the world.
But no storefront here, but you are in Best Buy.
Yeah, no storefront here. We're in Best Buy. We're also in Simply Mac, who are fantastic partners of ours, local company.
Great.
Yeah.
And then one of your premises was because Skullcandy was here, you would have the talent that you needed. Talk to us about the talent that you need on your team in order to successfully execute on your plan.
At the end of the day, we're essentially, we're a product marketing company. You know, we've got great R&D skills to actually build the product and to manage the supply chain. But where our core focus, particularly here in Park City, is, it's all around on supporting our online business. So we've got a fantastic digital marketing team. We've got a great sales team. We've also got all of our operations and support and logistics team is based here as well. So we've been very fortunate to find those people in the area, which has just been fantastic because it's not... I suppose you don't really come to a ski town looking for a career job, but the reality is we've found some people who've just been...
Ideally, you hope you do, and I think Park City's working hard to make it easier for our residents to find those career jobs. One of the things we talked to our guest about, this is a business show, the whole digital marketing, I mean, that's changed so much, really even just in the last 5 years. What makes a good digital marketer?
Wow, that's a big question. We're actually interviewing at the moment because we're expanding the team. A good digital marketer really needs to understand the three areas of digital marketing, which is paid, owned, and earned. You know, your paid media, that's the money that you're spending on Facebook, across search, across display advertising, or your owned media, which is your own website, which is all of the assets, your email, all of those digital touch points that you own and you push out that don't cost you. And then you're earned, which is your social strategy around Instagram and Facebook and so on. Now, if you've got a great all-rounder who understands how all of those different things can influence and connect, that's incredibly powerful. And if you know them, send them our way, please.
So you're looking for a director of digital marketing right now. Is that the title?
No, we're looking for a manager. We've got a fabulous director. And we're looking to expand the team because we've sort of built it to a point where we're overflowing and we now need to go to the next phase.
And how long has the position been open? Have you found it difficult to find the trifecta candidate?
No, we've actually narrowed it down to two or three, which has been fantastic. We're actually excited about a couple now, which is great.
And does being in Park City, I don't know if these folks live in Park City or they might be nationwide, does being in Park City... is that a plus to most candidates, or are folks from out of town, out of state, thinking, gee, moving to Park City is a big move?
It's a massive attraction. It really is. Like, what we're trying to do is, you know, we've got a culture in our office which is all about, you know, enjoying what's around us, but making the most of it. But, you know, when we're in the office, we work hard. So, you know, during the summer, we go mountain biking, you know, once or twice a week, early morning. Then we work hard during the day, but during the season, if it's a powder day. We did say that it was going to be a 4-inch rule because technically that's a big dump in Australia, but we realised no one would be working. So we just have a good rule. We get out there most days and go for a quick ski.
A powder day or in the last 2 weeks, a leaf day. The Leafs have been so amazing. I do have to say I had a meeting cancel on me this week, and I'm like, I'm taking a leaf afternoon and enjoying this beautiful foliage that's been in town. Well, Nick, thank you for joining us. Our guest has been Nick Smith. He is the Chief Executive Officer at Bridge Keyboards. I'm glad to hear everything's going so well, and we're glad you're here in Park City.
Thank you. Great talking.
You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. Please stay tuned.
Whitney Wall here from Park City Mountain and KPCW's sponsor. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We're going to switch gears now and talk on a topic that all of us here in Park City are interested in, which is good food. In studio with us now, I have Rudy Salvatore. And Rudy is with Makea Catering. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So your food specializes in Caribbean-inspired menu, including Haitian food?
Yes, yes.
And am I right that it's predominantly through a food truck?
No. Right now we were at the farmer's market. And we do catering event for any type of event. We cater, and we also do a private chef for...
That food truck in Pioneer Park is pretty popular, though. Yeah, Rudy?
Yes, the farmer's market. It was the first year, and we're one of the top food vendors. And I get so excited because so many times people, when they try the food for the first time, Haitian food, they get so excited, and they're like pleasantly surprised.
So what is Haitian food? Tell us.
Oh, my goodness. So I was obviously born and raised in Haiti, and I came here back in 2004. Also growing up, I started cooking when I was 11, and I just never stopped. Haitian food is rice and beans, vegetables. We eat a lot of seafood, goat, and pork and beef. So it's just delicious. We use a lot of spices.
But you brought chicken in one time, and it was wonderful. It was spicy.
Yes.
And you had something else that you could add for the spice to make it really hot. It was like a coleslaw, and you warned us and said, that's not regular coleslaw. It's like what you're eating in Texas. This, you got to watch out for this. It was spicy.
Yes. In Haiti, we call it piclis. And anyone who likes spicy food, we can add it. You add it to anything, like anything savory. So it's a, the way I best describe it is a non-fermented kimchi. So it's a fresh cabbage and carrots that's marinated with salt and pepper and lime and lemon juice and a whole lot of habanero pepper. So that's where the kick came from the habanero pepper.
What brought you here in 2004?
2004, I moved to Fort Lauderdale to be with my mother from Haiti. We had there was some political unrest there, and then my mom qualified for political asylum in the U.S., so I moved to Fort Lauderdale, and in 2008, I moved here to Park City to actually work with Park City Transit.
Oh, really?
Yes, that's where I started in Park City, with the transit.
Well, there's a real success story. So were you a bus driver here in Park City?
I was. I was the dancing and singing bus driver.
Well, there you have it, folks. If you remember Rudy, the singing, dancing bus driver in Park City, he is now your Haitian caterer. How did you make the transition from bus driving to cooking?
So back in 2012, I met a group of friends in college at a math class. So I wasn't really good at math, but I know when I work together with people, I kind of learn fast. And I asked them to do a study group. And they came to my house one Sunday, and I always look for an excuse to cook. So I was like, hey, you guys like dinner? And would like if I cook dinner for you? And they're like, sure. And from that first Sunday on, we just called it Sunday Dinner at Rudy's. And it just like never ended. And one day, my really good friend Heidi Campo, she say, Rudy, you should start a business because you cook so good. And I was like, okay, you know, I'll do that. And a couple of friends asked me to cater their weddings, and it just started from there. And again, starting to cook at 11, I'm always trying to find an excuse to cook. And when they asked me to do that, I was really excited.
So you've been doing it full time now for how many years?
For about 2.5 years.
And what percentage of your business is catering versus the food truck? Well, the food truck was just only a year,
at the
right?
Farmer's market, yeah, earlier this year. And the, I want to say about 60 to 75% is catering.
And so when someone hires you for a catering job, do you now bring the food truck over to their house and do it kind of fun, funky food truck style, or can you do a really high-end catering meal as well?
I do a high-end catering meal. I bring my my equipment with me and do a fine dining experience, Haitian style. Oh, sometimes I call it the island treatment.
And what is that experience like?
The island treatment, I usually do authentic Haitian food where I will cater a menu around the palate of the person. Say, what do you like? What, you know, how far are you willing to go?
How adventurous are you?
Yeah, exactly. How adventurous are you? And I go from there. And so I'll cater a menu based on what someone like, but I will stay authentically Haitian from that. I remember I donated a dinner here for the last fund drive that you guys had.
For our pledge drive, yes. Yeah, thank you for that.
Yes. And for that dinner, I made, I made oxtail that was cooked in red wine, and that was cooked for about 7 hours. And I also had a red snapper that was cooked like Haitian style. And I remember the guests there, they loved every bite of it.
We heard rave reviews about that, Rudy. Oxtail and red snapper.
Yes.
That was good.
Yes, that was part of the island treatment.
And Rudy, is your vision at some point to open a restaurant here in Park City, or do you see yourself focusing on catering?
Right now, for the next 5 years at least, I want to cater. I want to cater because with catering, I sit with someone and get and tell you about the food and design the menu just for you. And I like that one-on-one interaction. People get to see me and talk to me, and I love to talk to people. And in the restaurant setting, I'm not sure if I'm ready for that just yet.
That personalized touch is nice to find in a caterer. How, if people are listening to us and they want to reach out to you, how do they do that?
Right now, my website is still being worked on, but you can find me on Facebook. It's facebook.com/Makaya Catering, or you can contact me directly. My phone number is 801-493-5873, and I could also be reached by email. It's makayacaters@gmail.com.
And Makaya is spelled M-A-K-A-Y-A. Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
Awesome. Well, Rudy, congratulations on your success, and thanks for bringing joy to so many homes here in Park City with your catering and your work at Park Silly, and it sounds like Pioneer Park as well. And good luck to you in the future.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Mountain Money. Stay tuned. And after our underwriters, Renee and I are going to come back and wrap up the show.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com. Fred Marshall Painting.
The air briefly for just a second, having some technical difficulties, but I think we're back on, Doug.
I hope we are, and we'll find out. But we do want to thank our great sponsors for Mound Money. We couldn't do this show without you, so we thank our sponsors. They include Mountain West Bank, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Jones Waldo, Holbrook and McDonough, Park City Mountain, Park City Chamber Bureau, and Columbus Pacific Properties with Viridian Apex Residences.
And we started the show saying we had a smattering of guests and an eclectic variety
of
listeners.
Usually we come up with a theme, and this one there really wasn't a theme. It was a little eclectic.
Yeah, I kind of liked, you know, everybody that we chatted with, Mitchell talking about, you know, starting Red Ledges out there in Heber Valley in 2007, not the best time to be starting a big real estate development.
It's been hard to pick a more challenging time.
Yeah. Then Nick Smith, the CEO with Bridge Keyboards. Man, they're a big success story.
Yeah, no, and, you know, hardware is hard, and so kudos to them.
And Rudy Salvatore with Makaya Caters. Makaya is M-A-K-A-Y-A, Caters, C-A-T-E-R-S. He's got a story from Haiti, got moved out here in 2004, the son of a political asylum seeker, and now he used to be a bus driver in Park City. Now he has his own Haitian catering company.
Yeah,
that was fun to hear his story.
Charming young man and very fun story.
And he did bring some food here to the station a while ago. It was over the summer, and people were raving. It was good. And what was nice about it is that you could make it as mild or as spicy as you wanted, and that's always nice to have.
Yep. No, Park City, we're kind of an eclectic town. You started the show talking about the ski shot. Any update on that? Anything you want to share?
I have not seen anything from my friends at Sunrise Rotary about that other than I think it goes back to Breckenridge now. And I think Breckenridge tries to break the record in January, Doug. So I think it switches off. We do a fall event and they do a January event. But it was really fun to see all those people on Main Street. I think 1,250 people were there, and it was a wonderful afternoon. This has been Mountain Money. We are glad.